Hello and welcome to the Travelling Ergonomist podcast. I'm your host, Kirsty Angerer, and my job as an ergonomics consultant is to educate people on how to get their bodies into neutral postures. And in today's professional world, with the prominence of agile and remote working, ergonomics is more important than ever. So sit back, relax, and let's navigate the workplace together.
So part of the research we did on workplace health and well-being, one of the things that we did as a family is we all got our brain scanned through SPECT, S-P-E-C-T scanning with Dr. Amen. And one of the things he said is that for long-term memory and coordination, the cerebellum, the deep area, eye-hand coordination activities are great. And the things that kill that cerebellum is sitting doing work all day long. And so having good eye-hand coordination activities is something that rebuilds memory, rebuilds cognitive processing speed, the speed of processing and the memory retention.
Wow.
So that was my new boost or nudge to get a new racket and get out there and try it again.
Well, I hope we can connect in person one day then and have a game.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm so excited to have had Rex Miller on the podcast today. He's an award-winning author of 6 books in workplace wellness, team dynamics, executive coaching, strategic planning, and high-performance lifestyles. His definition of wellness is we should be able to bring our whole self to work, do our best work during the day, and go home happier and healthier. As many of you will know, I'm an avid tennis enthusiast, and it seems Rex is too, so our conversation naturally starts that way, as you've just heard. Our conversation then continues, and we open up discussion around workplace wellness, chronic disease, stress and sleep, this concept of WHOOP, using movement as part of recovery, workplace culture, and last but not least, his book, The Healthy Workplace Nudge. It's one of my absolute favourite episodes on the podcast, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did.
My expertise is in the whole world of making people happier and healthier in the workplace and the research we found all around that.
What started that journey?
Yeah, so the journey, I get sucked into most of the journeys that I take. I'm that person, you know, the movies where they say, don't open the door because... something bad. I'm the one who says, well, I need to see what's behind the door. So this has been an evolution, and it first started 12, 15 years ago now on trying to find out why most construction projects end up late, over budget, and everybody hates each other at the end. Mm-hmm. So I found a process of trying to unravel that problem. 70% of all construction projects come in late and over budget. The Egan Report in the UK was one of the standards we used to look at why projects consistently come in late and over budget. So the methodology I stumbled across was that the challenge was when I go to architects, they have their opinion. When I go to contractors, they have their opinion. Go to developers, they have their opinion. Owners have their opinion. And most of those opinions are pointing a finger at somebody else. So I said, well, to cut through all that, I'm going to get everybody in one room together. So we did. And it was not only game-changing for the discussion, but it changed my whole career because I was in the corporate space representing a distributor and a subcontractor for construction solutions for interior products. Just so frustrated by the whole process. So this process here led us to learn how to build create what we call early collaborative trust-based project teams, which goes against the typical structure on how project teams are chosen. That became a catalyst for a movement in the United States called integrated project delivery. And then the results of that then led to owners like Google saying, okay, you're helping us build a better project, but now What we really need is our solutions for our business problems. It's great that we have a great project, but how is that helping us engage our employees and be more productive? So I said, well, that's a great question. So then we pulled another group of people together, a bigger group of companies like Google and Cummins and several others, Hayworth and Balfour Beatty. We spent 2 years researching that and going to companies that were what we call positive outliers, breaking the rules but getting better results.
Okay.
Then we also had the challenge, people saying, we have a hard time when we need to change our business model or strategy changes, our cultures get in the way and really kill our efforts to change strategy. So we found some ways to tackle that, looking at what we call legacy culture, the culture that used to make you great but no longer, your aspired culture, which is kind of the BS culture, the one that you like to tell people that you are, but you aren't really. And then the shadow culture, which is really what we say, it's what happens when you're not there. It's the real culture that really operates the place. So how do you shift that? And we found some really great case studies, and one happened to be CBRE, the big global brokerage firm, and their headquarters in LA. It was an incredible project on how they use space as a catalyst to shift from very independent, kind of Lone Ranger culture. Lone Ranger is a character in the U.S. who was a cowboy who kind of did his own thing. And so how do we move to a team culture when we've had this reward system and culture of entitlement, so to speak, broker entitlement? Great story. Well, that at the end of that, I thought we were done telling the story, and then CBRE started buying all these copies of the book called Change Your Space, Change Your Culture. After about 500 copies that they purchased, I called the president and said, his name's Lou Horn. I said, Lou, thank you very much. My family appreciates all the orders. But what's going on? And he said, well, it's the story you told about our well building. I barely remembered what it was. It was like a footnote in the book.
Okay.
So he's telling me about this wellness journey they're on. And I'm not completely up to speed because I don't really remember it. And he said, we've had 14,000 visitors in the last 18 months to an office of 250 people. And then I said, I need to come out and see what's going on. So I went out and visited them, and they were the very first WELL certified space. So it's the International WELL Building Standard. Mm-hmm. Delos was the organization that started it. So I went back and kind of say, okay, I missed really the significance of this. I only looked at this as a great change leadership story, but obviously this has transformed and it's all around wellness. So then we pulled another group together like we have before of all these stakeholders to ask the question, what happened here? Is it a one-off deal or is there more to this story than meets the eye? And we had, you know, we had the president of Gensler there. We had two architects from Google. We had Balfour Beatty. We had, you know, 10 really substantial leaders all come away with the conclusion of this is important. We need to look into it more. So I can tell you what we did next, but you may have a question in the because I've been talking the whole time.
No, this is great. How long ago was that you dealt with CBRE?
So the certification, it was 2013 when they became the first well-certified building. It was 2014 when I went out, when our book got published. It was 2015 when I went out to kind of get the rest of the story.
Yeah.
And that's when we launched the new research. And we had two questions because we were all coming from kind of corporate real estate, facility management, architecture, construction. None of us were human resource people. None of us knew anything about benefits or wellness programs. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if you went to any of our conferences, Cornet, IFMA, or any of them, there are people out there talking about how to do wellness better. I call it the Wellness Tips and Tricks Show. But what we came away with is saying nobody really understands what they're talking about. So let's first do the research. What's the problem wellness programs are trying to solve? Mm-hmm. And number two, how good are they doing? Or how well is the wellness going? So that led me to my first conversation with Dr. Roizen. Dr. Roizen is the chief wellness officer for the Cleveland Clinic. He's the very first chief wellness officer in 1992. He became the first corporate wellness officer. He is an absolute character. Dan's about 5'7", maybe. Okay. He is 75 years old, but he developed this assessment called the Real Age Assessment, which measures your biological age against your chronological age. So his biological age is somewhere around 55, 56, but he's...
Wow.
Yeah. So, and the assessment tells you all the things you can do to live younger. So needless to say, I took that assessment to see where I was. Wasn't sure I wanted to know. But since that time, I have actually gotten 3 years younger than what I measured out there. So I'm about 9 years younger than my biological age, okay, having taken some of this to heart. So he gave us what we call the burning platform, and that is chronic disease. And the UK is experiencing the same thing, the rise of chronic disease. And what I didn't realize and didn't know is that in the United States, 50% of our population has some form of chronic disease. 70% are either overweight or obese. The average high school student goes into college, 20% of them go in overweight or obese, 40% come out overweight or obese. So that, you know, wrapping my mind around this. Now, I spent 2 full days with him on 2 separate times because it just blew me away so much. And I was so disturbed. I mean, truly, truly disturbed by what he was saying. And the rate is rising at about a 7% compounded rate a year. So what that means is that if you look at the health costs in the United States, we spend about $3.5 trillion a year on health costs. 80% of that goes to chronic disease. If you look at the traditional causes of chronic disease, there are 4 primary behaviors. It's eating too much of the wrong kinds of food, it's smoking, it's abuse of drugs and alcohol, and it's sedentary lifestyle, sitting around, yeah, you know, watching or whatever, working all day long. And so so that became really clear, but there was a missing piece that we found later that changed everything we understood. So it's rising at 7% compounded rate. So within 10 years, that means without any change, it's going to double, which means we go to about $7 trillion, which means that corporate expenditures double, our taxes double. So basically, he said, Dr. Roizen said, within the next 5 to 7 years, if nothing changes, our economy shuts down. It's game over. So that was a bit disturbing. And then all of the things that happen with chronic disease, the increase in Alzheimer's, the knee surgery, you know, knee replacements, hip replacements, yeah, all these things are byproducts of chronic disease. So I come back and we say, let's look at wellness programs and see what they're doing. So we looked deeply at them, and we even went to the number one advocate for wellness programs, who I won't mention on the podcast, but he's in the book.
Sure.
And he goes through 10 important features of wellness programs in order for them to work. Number one, you have to have committed, consistent, walk-the-talk leadership. So right there, that's the number one criteria out of 10. Right there, we took 80% of companies off the roster of being able to do this. We looked at all of the things you need to do, and I asked him, this is hard. How many companies do you find can even do this? And I've got his words recorded, and it's very, 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 very few companies are capable of implementing an effective wellness program. That's capable.
Why is that?
Well, you got to have robust leadership. You have to have a really effective communications program. You have to have effective change management. Now, you left the corporate world because new ideas aren't adopted well. You have to have great data, long-term data on health baselines and measure that. Most wellness programs are implemented by third party who don't keep robust data, and you change those third parties. You need to have good change advocates. You need to have change your environment. You need to have really robust incentives. All of these things have to happen. So if you take that, then you find, well, most companies can't. And he said less than 5% are even capable. Then we went to Soren Matke, who is the author of the RAND Report. It's a 10-year analysis of wellness programs in the United States, if they work or not. Their conclusion is they don't work. They're a waste of money, and they're invasive. So we came back, and now wellness programs across the world, it's about a $4.3 trillion industry. So there's a wellness industrial complex. So you can imagine my coming back to the group saying, well, number one, we're not wellness experts. Number two, we've got to tell the world that wellness programs don't work. How are we going to pull that off? And are you in this? Because if we're going to do this, then we have to really know what we're talking about. So that was really the primary focus of the book.
Okay.
And then
okay.
Looking at the alternatives, if wellness programs don't work and we have this burning platform, what can corporate leaders do? And we found four key, very fundamental, important strategies that are much more effective, affect your entire workforce. Wellness programs only engage less than 15% of employees to begin with. So I'll pause, and then we can go into the four strategies that we found that were highly effective in terms of helping people live a happier and healthier life in the workplace and outside.
And is that what you define wellness as?
Well, that's a good question. You know, so my definition for wellness in the workplace is different than the World Health Organization or others. And mine's really simple. It's we should be able to bring our whole self to work every day, do our best work during the day, and go home happier and healthier. So if we can get a metric around that, and I think we can because we can measure leading indicators, that should be the goal. The current standard is, did we get more people to participate this year than last year, which is a lousy metric. And so all the games are, how can we get a few more people to sign up or take their health risk assessments or biometric screening or whatever? All those are exercises in missing the point. And so the big discovery we found when we went to the Mayo Clinic, going back to those four behaviors.
Yeah.
So what do you think drives those four behaviors? Think about those four behaviors again. Eating too much of the wrong kinds of food, smoking, too much consumption of alcohol or drugs, sitting and vegging out.
Probably stress.
That's it. That's the whole thing. And yet we've got the cart before the horse, because if you look at all the wellness programs, how many of them really focus on reducing stress at work?
Very few at all.
Yeah. So they focus on Fitbits and all that. So that was the big aha for us, is we've got to go to root cause. So if root cause is stress, and unless we're dealing with that, all the incentives we use to get people not to smoke, and I mean, how many people don't know that that's bad for you? So it's not that we don't know, and it's not that we don't have the right incentives. It's that we're not dealing with the root cause, which is stress. So that became kind of the the focus of the research going forward is what reduces stress, what creates a healthy work environment, and how do we do that?
And have you, since doing that research and, you know, traveling around the world, are there companies now who are starting to do it right or starting to think about it differently?
Well, no, not really. Okay. I mean, some. There's a small percentage, okay? So we divided companies into what we call three categories of tackling wellness. The first category in the majority is looking at it and asking the question, how do we reduce costs and reduce risk? The second group, which is a smaller group, and typically those companies that have highly paid employees, they're looking at it through as a, how do we retain and attract employees? You know, the high-tech firms, the financial firms. So it's a perk. But then there are a few companies out there that look at it as a fundamental human right or value. So we found like Barry Waymiller in the U.S., Patagonia, Cummins, Diesel, GoDaddy, mm-hmm. And I'm sure you've got some in the U.K. you would put in the same category as well. But those, and it's interesting, they don't focus so much on programs as they focus on culture. So we made the difference, the distinction between a healthy culture and a culture of health, where those that are pursuing a culture of health are pursuing all the programs for all the good reasons, all great reasons.
Yeah.
But it really gets simple when you're creating healthy culture, a place where people can do their best work, can feel psychologically safe, get the personal development, skill development mm-hmm. they need, feel a sense of accomplishment at the end of the day, and are appreciated for what they do. That seems more common sense, seems easier to do, but for whatever reason, most companies don't do that. They would default to the programs versus making it a great place to work.
Do you think that's because, so I work with a lot of businesses that won't put an ergonomics program in place, for example, because they think that it's going to open a can of worms.
Yeah, so it's fear-based and it's risk management-based. And so they don't want, you know, 1,000 people asking for adjustable desks or claims to start coming in, whatever it is. And the challenge is that the cost they're paying already for missing days, employees that leave, and the message that they're communicating to them as well.
Yeah.
The companies like CBRE, one of the interesting things that they said the benefit was is people feel that we care for them. They're going home telling their families how great it is to work for a company that cares for us. We miss that. And for whatever reason, leaders, I think, are isolated from the real world. They, you know, they're structurally, they don't see what life is like. They don't see the single mom who may be, you know, standing on their feet all day long, or doing mind-numbing clerical work or call center. They don't see what the lives are like, and they don't see what happens to them when they go home and have to take care of an elderly parent or a child with special needs or just trying to keep things together. And what's happening is they're living a shorter life. The Whitehall report, I don't know if you read the Whitehall study.
I haven't, no.
But they did a study in the UK on the mortality rate, the morbidity and mortality rate of mid-management level workers. And they found that their lives are shortened because of the stress that they experience. It's huge. I mean, just helping people feel better, just getting up, you know, I've got different devices, Oura Ring, and it'll tell me, hey, you need to get up and stretch your feet.
Yeah, I actually noticed I'm connected with you on LinkedIn, and you every day submit your Whoop score.
Yeah, my daily whoop. Yeah.
What is that all about?
Well, so that's interesting too, because of the tennis connection that we've got.
Yes.
So I follow professional sports recovery, and I've had the privilege of coaching some really high performing athletes from a cognitive level, not from the kind of the technical level. So we do a lot of that for executive coaching. We do cognitive training. And what I started seeing is more and more research on recovery and how important recovery was. And something called overtraining syndrome, which looks a lot like chronic fatigue and depression. And it also causes your body to break down. And, you know, athletes don't always know, you know, professional athletes and high-performing athletes always push it. You know, if there's no pain, there's no gain. I lost you there. Are you still here?
Oh, yep. Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah. So I started looking at this and wondering and seeing that there was technology now around to measure, to help people know your nerve endings in the brain. You don't have nerve endings in the brain, so you don't know when you're pushing yourself too far. So they're starting to get devices. Here's my Whoop, for example. That measure something called heart rate variability. Heart rate variability is a key metric and a new emerging metric around resiliency. And it lets you know how capable you are of taking on stress or strain. Those words are synonymous, stress or strain. And so there's three kinds of stress or strain. There's physical stress or strain, cognitive, and emotional. Well, in the research, what I learned is that your autonomic nervous system, you know, your adrenaline that goes when you're ready to perform, it's the same mechanism that engages when you see a police car behind you with the lights go on, or you get that email in the morning and it just sets your whole day off. Your heart rate raises, your breathing increases, you go into this fight or flight mode or performance mode, and that's your sympathetic nervous system. So I decided to measure my daily events like they were sports events. So when I got up and gave a keynote presentation, I gave a keynote presentation for a group at Uber last November, and I measured. It was an hour and a half, okay? And actually 2.5 hours if you count the rehearsal. Guess how many calories I burnt up with that during that time?
Oh, maybe a few hundred.
Yeah, okay. That's what you would expect. My heart rate got up to 165. So that's that you're on stage, ready to go.
Yeah.
I burnt up 1,800 calories in that hour and a half. So then the connection was, oh my goodness, that explains why if you work on a project all day long and you feel wasted and you're wondering, why am I so tired? I didn't do anything.
Yeah.
You did. So all that. So then I started communicating with Whoop, and I went out there and started talking about, okay, is this real? Is what we're measuring real stuff? And they said, absolutely. The difference is, as an athlete, you're burning off the jet fuel, the cortisol, in the physical effort. But as workers, so that's the importance of getting up and moving around, you know, every 90 minutes, 45 minutes. Just a couple minutes of doing that flushes the cortisol out of your system, and so that doesn't build up during the day. So all that buildup during the day, then what happens is about 2 in the morning, if you don't burn it off, about 2 in the morning, you wake up because your liver is purging all that, and then it affects your sleep. So we started looking at the Johnson & Johnson Human Performance Institute coined a phrase called the corporate athlete. So we've been borrowing that to make the connection that we have athletes going on all day, athletic activities going on in the workplace all day long, but unlike an athlete, and you know, on the tennis court, you go and you rest, you go and you rest, you go and you rest. In the workplace, you just go all day. So we're talking about how do we build in recovery time? How do we look at rhythms and cycles of work rather than just all day? How do we do high value work when we're freshest and do other work during the day. So how do we manage our energy versus our time? So that led into the whole daily loop.
Amazing. Well, I think I might have to go and get myself one of these bands. Definitely.
There you go.
It's interesting you say that, actually, because I do a lot of seminars and workshops, much like you do. And last week I was doing a workshop in Manchester, and I was there from probably 8 in the morning till 4 p.m. And, I love talking about ergonomics. So it's not anything stressful or anything like that. But I was exhausted by the end of the day. Exhausted. And it wasn't because, we had great conversations, great discussions, but obviously my adrenaline was so high that it kind of made me fatigued by the end.
Yeah. So part of your work now is to help people learn how to use movement for recovery.
Yes.
And to understand all that stress you built up.
Yeah.
How do you get that out of your system so that you can go home and have a good night's sleep and not take the extra glass of wine? Because that's, again, the stress, you go home and you feel that stress buildup. So most people's coping strategies are, an extra beer at the pub, watching an extra hour of whatever TV show or binging on Netflix or whatever it is. Those are the things that we can help educate people as to what's going on, and then they can do something different.
So are you saying that movement is the best thing to do to counteract that? Or is there something else?
So there's a couple of things. One, breathing. So breathing resets your vagus nerve. And the vagus nerve resets your whole autonomic nervous system and puts you back into a rest state. So breathing or meditation, a power nap, and going out and just walk every 30 to 45 minutes to an hour or so, get up and take a true break, not email break, not social media break, because your mind, it's your mind that you're frying. So movement, getting out in the sunlight, taking your shoes off, stepping in natural grass, all of that just gives you that recovery and flushes that cortisol out of your system.
Amazing. Well, hopefully some people take some of these tips and start doing them.
Yeah, they're simple things, but we just don't know what we don't know.
Well, so how do you, I think a lot of people probably know some of that. They know that they should move more. They know that they should get out in the sunlight more, because everyone keeps telling us that. Right. How does a business create that culture? Because from an employee's perspective, if you start taking that movement break every hour to go outside, they feel that their bosses are looking at them in a different light and they're not doing as much work.
Absolutely. So one example, GoDaddy, for example, does encourage it. Management encourages it. And they have an area you can go in the office and chill out, play a game of table tennis, do a wall climb. They've got this, rock climb wall thing.
Okay.
But what was happening is nobody was using it. The reason is it was in the back. So when people walked back, it was a signal that, they're doing something they're not supposed to. So what they did is they took it and moved it to the very front. So as you go up on the second floor, the very first thing you see is a putting green and these other things and these little go-karts you can ride throughout. So it's a clear signal and message. So the environment, the way you design the environment tells people, gives them messages. It says, this is what we do. This is how we do it. This is what you have permission to do. And then anytime it's fuzzy, people will default to, I better not do that, because I just don't know if it's permission. The second thing is, of course, what leaders say is permitted, but more importantly, what they do if they model the same behavior. So the gap between what they say and what they do, what gets rewarded or recognized and what gets punished. So as soon as somebody takes a break and somebody comes back and the manager says, what were you doing? Boom, you're done.
Yeah.
It goes through the office. But as soon as someone says, hey, I'm glad you took that break, welcome back, we're excited that you're going to do whatever your best work. So recognition and reward is part of it. The environment, how you design the environment, is part of it. And then the things that you, the bad behaviors that you tolerate also. So if you have a manager who's kind of punitive and you tolerate that, then that sets the norm as well. So those are things companies can do to kind of reset the tone. But the most important thing is if people don't see managers and leaders, a good example. So I'm working with a company. The whole executive team is on the Whoop, and I'm tracking them as a team, like their sports team.
Okay.
So I see their sleep and their strain and all of this. And the reason they did that is, number one, they wanted to make sleep their number one professional development habit. But number two, they were having a hard time getting their people to take time off and take vacations because the managers were still working 60 hours a week or plus. So they had to restructure their calendars and their schedule. They now turn off emails at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on Fridays and then back on Sunday. They're being monitored on their sleep. They're checking in with their spouses and saying, how is the weekend going? Are you getting, is your partner really taking it easy or working? So those are things leaders have to do or the culture is not going to change.
But how do you get leaders to think that way? Because like you said, at the moment, many businesses, the gap between leaders and the rest of the employees is so big. And they're not part of that, you know, understanding about the single mom coming in. And
yeah, right.
How do you change that?
Well, so that's a big, usually the change is when they have a problem. So I had an executive who went to the doctor, and the doctor told him that if he doesn't change, my first question was how do you sleep? That's usually my first question is, how's your sleep? How much sleep are you getting? Anybody that tells me they're getting 6 or less hours of sleep, I pounce on that because I know they're feeling tired, they're feeling fatigued, they're not making their best decisions. And so we work on that, and I challenge them to say, just one week, you know, go to bed now, at this time, get up, and tell me how you feel and how that makes you feel during the day. The other executive told me that he bought a car specifically because it will catch you if you fall asleep. It'll bump you if you start.
Oh my gosh!
I know, because he caught himself, you know, dozing. And there's these little micro, you know, when you're really fatigued, you will go on these 2 to 3 second mini checkouts. Where your mind just checks out for a couple seconds. And if you're driving, it of course can be fatal. So helping people relate, most people are tired, fatigued, running on adrenaline. So the way I do it when I'm working with an executive is have them just unpack their own life. And then once they're in tune and have some self-awareness, then they can build a more broad awareness.
I like that. Yeah, that's a good question to ask people, I think. How are you sleeping?
Yeah. Right. And anybody that tells you they can get by with less than 6 hours of sleep, not so. You cannot.
So I wanted to ask you, what was the idea behind the title of your new book, The Healthy Workplace Nudge? Because it's quite an interesting title, and especially the word nudge, I quite liked.
Well, so nudge comes from Dr. Richard Thaler's work as a behavioral economist. And so nudging is a way, it's a little bit of how the brain works. You know, your brain uses up 25% of your calories all day long. And so it's divided into kind of two functioning parts. And this was developed by Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, all of which have won Nobel Prizes in economics. So they literally changed the whole theory or shifted how we think about how people make decisions. That's what economics is, how people make decisions. And so what happens is that 80% of the time your brain is in default mode because it's conserving calories. So have you ever driven down the highway and we're able to talk to somebody at the same time?
Definitely.
Okay. So your brain is in default mode because driving is automatic and talking is all pretty easy to do. Mm-hmm. But when you decided to pass a large truck, you may have found that you stopped talking and you focused on the driving. Well, you just experienced that shift into the part of your brain that's reserved for survival or important decisions. That's about 20% of the time. So what they found is that people don't make rational decisions because most of the decisions they make are not life and death. In the United States, we have McDonald's, and they have this thing called supersizing. So you go to McDonald's and you order your normal meal, and they said, would you like to be supersized? In other words, for another quarter, I can get this 32-ounce thing of poison plus extra carbohydrates in the fries. You can do that for just 25 cents. So the brain normally is thinking, whoa, that's a deal. That's the heuristic. You know, I'm getting more than I'm spending. So you go ahead, and that was a nudge. Or you go out with friends and you're having a good time eating, but you said, you know, I've been out a few times this week. I'm going to take it easy. I'm only going to have one glass of wine. But you're caught up in the conversation and you didn't keep track of how many times the waiter came by to fill up your glass of wine. And then at the end of it, what does the waiter ask? At the end of everyone's meal, what does the waiter ask? Would you like dessert?
Yep.
Now, you're going to be good, and you're not going to be the first one, but a friend orders dessert, and you say, oh, what the heck? You know, you were nudged, right? So what that means is that we're irrational. What you started out thinking what was in your best interest, you gave that up, but the thinking is, or the theory in the economic practice is that we're predictably irrational. So if we know how to take advantage of people, so for example, in the workplace, Google has these refrigerators where they have all this free beverage, and the top half of the refrigerator is clear glass, the bottom half is frosted glass. In the top half at eye level, it's the Fiji water, the kombucha, the coconut water. I call those all the California drinks. And in the bottom, in the frosted, where you have to make an effort to go for it, it's the little outline of a red can and a green can and a burgundy can. They put out very fresh foods, healthy foods that are on easy display. Those are taking advantage of the fact that we can be nudged into making those behavioral choices. Having work surfaces that nudge you. So Dr. Mark Benden, who I mentioned, he developed a desk that after every 45 minutes or so, it'll just do a little bit of a bump. And okay. So that's a nudge to remind you, I need to get up. I need to do something. So there's all kinds of designs that you can put in place in policy and in the environment that put a bias on one behavior over another. One place we read about puts a 3-second delay in the elevator, but they make the hallways, the stairs, really nice. And so do I want to wait 3 seconds, or it's nicely lit and it's an entertaining way down and it's one floor, so I'm going to do that. So that's the idea of a nudge. And so we applied that throughout the book. And how can we use design nudges, policy nudges, culture nudges to help shift people to pick better behavior?
I love that. It's probably one of the best words I've heard in a long time to describe, you know, how we get wellness back into the workplace. Really interesting.
Yeah, there's all kinds of things we can do. And a lot of it is just being thoughtful about it, not falling into the traditional thinking that we have about wellness and well-being.
Yeah, I like it as well because it's a word that's kind of engaging. Everybody understands it. It's not jargon that a scientist has created that we don't understand.
Yeah, and another nice thing about nudge, it's not a mandate. You know, it's, you're not forcing people to, you know, you can take, here's the healthy food here. And if you want the cake, you have to reach to get the cake. But if you want the healthy stuff, it's right there and ready to go.
I think I'd be the one reaching for the cake, unfortunately, but I'm getting better.
Well, you know, so we put that in what we call the well-being category. That may not be the wellness category, but, you know, there's a certain psychological benefit for having that cake.
Definitely. So we spoke very early on. I think you mentioned four strategies.
Yes.
So can you help us with those?
Yeah. So one is the nudge. So that's one of the strategies, going through doing the nudges. Number two is a building a healthy environment. So the International Well-Building Standard, and in the United States, FitWell, give you protocols and design strategies for creating a healthy work environment. So we live 90% of our lives in a built environment. And up until 2013, we did not realize how to comprehensively create a measurably healthier environment. So the lighting that you're experiencing, you know, you've got some daylight coming in.
Yeah.
That's going to improve your cognition, your digestion, and your sleep. Now, if you were in a room that was completely closed and it was fluorescent lights, that would equally affect, negatively affect your cognition, your digestion, and your sleep. The O2 level. So designing a healthy workplace is number two. Let's see, number three, if I can remember these. Reducing the stress at work, giving people, designing space that makes sense. We call it legible space intuitively. So I don't know if you've ever been in a hospital and tried to find your way around and your stress level goes up because you're trying to find somebody, but it's just a nightmare. And you've been in another place that immediately gives you permission to just relax and feel good. So designing places that are psychologically comforting and intuitive to navigate. I know exactly what I can do here and where to go and how to get around. So we call that legible space. So that's number three. And giving people user choice, options. I can adjust my worktop. I can adjust my chair. I can rearrange my environment the way I want it to work. So user choice is another way of reducing stress in the workplace. And then the fourth one is something we learned from GoDaddy. And what GoDaddy employed is a process used in some hospitals and a lot of high-level hospitality, like the Ritz-Carlton or the Four Seasons. And they have this thing they call a guest journey. And so they'll plot a guest coming from the airport to the parking lot to the reception, and all of those are touch points. So what GoDaddy did is looked at all the touch points an employee has throughout the day, and they've trained their facility staff. Number one, they look at these touch points and look at, are they neutral points, friction points, or positive points? And then they go through looking at how they can improve each of those touch points. But then they've trained their facility services people as experience managers. So they're not janitors and they're not food services. They're experience managers. And the metaphor they gave them is, this is a cruise ship, and your job is to make each of our guests or employees help them have a wonderful time. They're actually trained that at 10 feet, they look at you, give you eye contact. At 5 feet, they give you a greeting, but they're looking at your expressions. Are you stressed? Are you happy, or whatever it is? And if you're stressed, they'll say, you know, Crystal, what can I do to help you? And you may say, well, I've got to go to this meeting, but I need to get this printed and I'm just flustered. And they'll say, well, let me take care of that printing for you, and it'll be on your desk when you're there. So that's a cool service. It's a cool training. It's part of their culture. So those are the four things: the touch points, the friction points at work, reducing the stress by design, legible space and user choice, nudges, and then building a healthy environment.
And would you say they're equally important, or is one more important than the other? So if a business was going in and going through this process now, what should they start with? Everything or one?
Well, so again, we designed this so you don't need executive level support. The easiest to do are the nudges. And we actually, we do a fun thing in our presentation, and we do a nudge audit. And then we tell people we're going to certify you as nudgeologists. So you go back to your place and you look for positive nudges and negative nudges. So for example, if there's a candy dish at the reception station, that's a negative nudge. So we do those both psychological stress points and mm-hmm. health points. And that's the easiest thing to do. The second part is looking at giving people more user choice, ergonomic devices, things they can adjust, and helping build in some kind of reminders as to actually use them, giving them permission to use them. And then building a healthier environment, a lot of that can be done just through, you're changing out your light bulbs, commissioning your HVAC, doing a lot of things simply and easily. So that's a lot of our strategies. How can you do this without getting executive level support and lots of budget money?
Okay, that's great. Thank you for that advice. That was brilliant.
Good.
I have one last question for you.
Okay.
As a futurist, you're a futurist. I can say that, can't I?
Yeah,
my degree. What does the future of workplace look like to you, or function like to you, or what would you like it to be like?
Well, so at least in the United States, the mental health issue is reaching a tipping point where companies are beginning to take it seriously and beginning to ask the right questions. Until we take away the stigma that people have lives and they're complicated, and until we get to the point where you can feel that you can bring your whole self to work, that I think we're reaching a tipping point. So a little bit of this is my hope for the future of work, is that it can become a place where you can bring your whole self to work, and then you can engage in work that's meaningful for you and come home at the end of the day happier and healthier.
Amazing. Well, I look forward to those kind of workplaces.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you're out there changing the world, so make sure you continue to preach the message.
Definitely trying to, that's for sure. Definitely. Rex, how can people get in touch with you after the podcast goes out, or where can they get your books, that kind of thing?
Yes. So LinkedIn, and you'll get a daily whoop update on my LinkedIn. So it's just Rex Miller. And then my website is rexmiller.com, www.rexmiller.com. And then all the books are on Amazon. We're working on a new book on the mental health and education. And so that'll come out in October or November. Yeah. Thanks so much for reaching out. This has been a fun interview, and I hope your listeners get something they can take away.
I'm sure they will. No, well, I certainly have, and I'm going to definitely turn my laptop off in a few hours and sleep better tonight.
There you go. Okay. All right.
Thanks, Rex.
Okay. Take care. Uh-huh. Bye-bye. Bye.